On the proposed heritage preservation ordinance, which we all received. I'm open to some guidance from the council, but what I think would be most productive today is we don't want to get into, you know, nitpicking the words and really tearing apart the ordinance language. I think where the group would benefit is understanding the council, you know, how do we feel about some of the fundamental principles of what we're trying to accomplish here? As you read the proposed ordinance, what did you think about the process for how properties are added to or removed from the list? How do you feel about the criteria that are used that would put properties on the list? What do you think about the appeal process for those that might disagree? And then finally, we might want to talk about incentives. Is this a program that we're going to want to provide some incentives, financial or otherwise? So. Again, I'd appreciate some conversation, and we can ask questions of Aaron or Jeff Allman is here to respond to questions that where they could expound on some of the details of how they arrived at some of the language. But again, my intent or hope is that we keep it fairly high level and not get down in the weeds too much, given that we have an hour and a half. So, any other thoughts? Otherwise, we can kind of dive in. With that in mind, I would maybe look to Aaron and or Jeff to give us the real high level, because you've got quite the file there, and I know you guys have spent a lot of time on this, and thank you for that. Much appreciation. Are there some high level things that you think we ought to focus on as we go through this? Either.
I think basically, as kind of another recap again, you know, the HPC had a kind of a sub-task force that got together to work through the ordinance. And it was HPC members, it was representatives from the community, it was representatives from the Minnesota State Historical Society, and we really took a number of different ordinances that were out there. We tried to kind of pull together and put together what we thought would be a reasonable ordinance for the city, but at the same time, you know, taking a look at that, the State Historic Preservation Office, they do have kind of standards that they like to see in a heritage preservation ordinance. We want to make sure that we met those standards. This is just the file of some of the working copies, and we have many more. We went through a lot of meetings. A lot of versions and drafts, and we kind of went back and forth a lot on it. We did come up with a draft. It did go to the full HPC. They did review it. They made some minor changes, and that's what was presented to the council back in November. And then at your direction, Terry has provided your memo that you guys have in the packet again, where he has arranged what we did into actually what our ordinance format is, since we weren't necessarily working in that kind of same timeline. He moved some things around, but he kept all the intent there. Nothing was changed from what the HPC had approved and recommended to the council. Some things were moved around, but that all the details are still there. And there's also some comments in there from the planning department as well for that. But I think basically what the ordinance does is establishes a couple levels of properties or districts for designation. You have your landmark properties, which are the ones that are identified as properties that should be preserved, that are definitely historic in relation to the city, and that we need to provide some sort of protection to, and then on the flip side, also provide some sort of incentives to those property owners to be able to maintain, improve, reuse, whatever it might be for those properties. And then also another list, which was our potential properties, where there is a probable, there's a probability that they could have some historic significance to the city, but they would need further study. We would need to have a third party that specializes in review take a look at those properties to see should they be moved up onto that landmark list. And with that, then, we lay out the criteria of how do you determine what's a landmark property, how do you determine potentially landmark, and then the process to get on the list, get off the list, how can you make improvements or changes, how can ultimately, how can you demolish a property, things like that. And we used for the ordinance all existing ordinances from other places and the federal, I guess, I'm not sure what the department is, but it's in the parks, that they have model guidelines for cities to use for ordinances, and we copied heavily from those, especially the criteria. So when you look at things information needed to determine economic feasibility, if you're going to say that this property is no longer economically feasible, we need to alter it, ultimately maybe even demolish it. We use existing criteria that are out in either model ordinances or existing ordinances in other places that we know have worked, have been proven to be legally defensible, those sort of things. So, I think it really expands on what we have greatly. And there's still a lot of work, I think, to be done with parts of it. We talked about, in this ordinance, really the restrictions and requirements, and we only briefly touch on the incentives. The HPC has developed a model loan / grant program that we can bring to the council once we determine how this is going to go. With that, of course, you need to determine the funding amount, and so that's the biggest piece of that program. The actual loan grant program, the criteria and things are fairly easy, but it's how much money is going to be involved and available to these properties. And then the other part of it is the zoning incentives. And we've talked with planning about this. That's a different section of the ordinance that will have to be amended, but we would need to take a look at it. We do have examples from other cities that allow for properties that, say, have a landmark designation to almost like an incentive development process where you are allowed to do some things that other properties in that zoning district wouldn't do because you are a designated property. And again, another incentive for somebody to want to have and keep their property on that list. So, really, I think it was a lot of work. It was a lot of back and forth and a lot of input, and I think we need more input on it, of course, from the public, from the property owners, from all sides of the issue before I think we finalize things. But yeah, I think it's a great start, at least a kicking off point for discussion.
And I think it's noteworthy that, according to the notes I've got here, that the task force and HPC unanimously ratified the draft. And perhaps more significant is that the State Historic Preservation Office ratified the draft, which leads us toward achieving the certified local government status, which is important because that potentially opens the door to some other funding or financing opportunities. So from a policy standpoint, I think you've done great work getting us to this point. All right, any questions for Aaron? Otherwise, we'll let Ms. Roman comment. All right, Jeff?
Oh, thank you for having us today. And I would say, first off, I routinely engage in conflict and mediation and crisis and things, and this has been among the more challenging things I've ever been in. The council, first off, the mayor interviewed candidates that applied. We were unanimously selected by the council, and it's been a struggle to maintain that sovereignty, if you will. This process has been influenced or disrupted, depending on your point of view, more by non-members, non-elected bystanders than any that I've seen. And so the vocal activists, I think are something you're going to have to deal with in this ordinance and have the resolve to stand behind it, whatever it is. It's going to be tough. These are heartfelt, very personal, very intimate beliefs, and people will go to far extremes to acknowledge it.
And I think we obviously want to get past that. I think we're talking about a topic that can be very passionate for people, and in some cases subjective.
Well, but it's passionate to the non-owners. It's passionate to the people outside the elected process. And somehow we have to find that orderly, whether it's a trial and a judgment, whether it's a ordinance, whether it's a ruling, somehow we have to make these stick. I know it's a challenge in government everywhere, zoning appeals. I mean, they happen all the time, but this is going to be a messy one because all of these buildings exist. All of these buildings have challenges. My second point is that codes change and the buildings don't. Building codes have evolved. Many of these buildings were prior to any building code. The authorities have in jurisdiction, whether it's the fire department or the building department or the planning and zoning, they have some ability to flex how they apply certain rules. And these kinds of developers, more than other kinds, have lots of money issues and how to get it done issues to begin with. And they're worse when the authorities are very rigorous and narrow in their interpretations. One that I'm involved, for example, Ioneal Town Hall Estates on Center Street. It's a 45,000 square foot building on a 2-acre lot that a prior city council decided we don't want high density housing, so they zoned it as a duplex. So any use of that building without any remodeling at all required a conditional use permit and the full public hearing and the jeopardy of going through a city council meeting. These are tremendously high risk stakes for a developer.
Nonetheless, I think it's good that we have some positive examples. As trying as it's been, Old City Hall, now the Conway Mass Building, the Payne Furniture Building.
I agree, but there are huge risks, and if it really is the public body's intention to support this objective, these developers just simply do not have the capacity to put a landing every 10 feet or create handicap access every single place, or, you know, there has to be some even-handedness, or not. I mean, you're the ruling body of making that moral decision. A third point, I went to the Chateau Theater presentation and was really intrigued by the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota having the power of yes instead of the power of no, and how deliberately they apply that. They want old buildings not to go in the dumpster, and they will make virtually any sacrifice to get part of the project some of the way, turn it into a productive, adaptive reuse of some kind. My experience in the 19 projects I've done in 8 National Historic Register properties has been the State Preservation Office is also pretty rigorous about that, and they stop projects. If you really mean that you want these to be on the tax roll, productive properties, members of our everyday society, and I think the Conway Mass Building is an interesting, great example, you got to find a way to help them become something that they weren't originally. Not all of them can be museums. So the power of yes as opposed to no is my opinion how to approach it. We debated passionately for years. There were Chamber of Commerce task forces and Rochester Builders and a whole group of activist groups that had an opinion of how do you trade off public and private rights, and when are these community resources and when are they private property. There's a lot of case law on that. The state has statutes on that. My opinion is I hope you don't create an ordinance that you can't defend. So simple as that. I think subsidy is a better way than coercion. I really like the RDA program where they have matching funds. The group decided that this ordinance would deal with the outside, but not the inside of buildings. That's a judgment call. I'm okay with that. You know, the group process happened. But I think a lot of the architectural and historic features of these buildings are inside them also. So it's possible the ordinance doesn't reflect it, but maybe a subsidy would. I don't know how to come up with a rule that applies everywhere all the time, but I know that if you put money toward these these projects, they're more likely to happen better.
And I think that speaks to the point of it's good to have a partnership. Certainly the building or property owners will have skin in the game in terms of what they choose to invest. And if we are, as a community, are truly serious about preservation, then we should probably have some stake in the game as well.
Okay, now I was just going to mention, too, we didn't touch on the list that the HPC had proposed for their landmark properties, the potential landmark properties. Because this was the initial proposal, they didn't want to make that judgment call on the ones that really weren't clear-cut. So the ones that are recommended on the landmark list are the existing properties in the community that are on the National Register of Historic Places. And then on the potential list are the ones that are fairly universally accepted as being probably or potentially historic, at least in relation to the city of Rochester. But still, we got that list down to, I think, 121 properties. Of the potentially, and this is working off the kind of the start list, which was almost 550 properties. So we were able to really narrow that list down, but we also didn't just want to, the HPC as a whole didn't want to start making judgment calls without the proper review of the properties. So they kept still 120 some properties on that potential list that would need further review if they were to move into that landmark designation or the council wanted to see them move to that.
So these are the
numbers. We've had very little owner input to these things. So the 11 on the landmark list or National Historic Register, which at some point in that building's life took a signature from an owner. Yeah. Then we got lost in the weeds a little bit about do you only apply these tests to the for-profit property tax-paying entities? What a Mayo, what a church, what a... Then we kind of get lost in that. If we really want to advance something that's historic, it doesn't matter who the owner is. We should try to subsidize what's historic, and then we get lost. You know, the Whiting House at Central Park, which is would use city money to subsidize the park district. I don't know. Then there's these 125 that probably were important to somebody, including the owners, and that 121. And we had, I think, one entry just for the 134 houses on the Pill Hill Historic District. And then you get lost again. What are the pros and cons of participating in the program?
Okay. Questions? Mr. Kakampi.
I appreciate, and I think we're all probably picking up on a bit of the, I don't want to say confrontation, but the nature of kind of battling and hammering out that takes place with a lot of this ordinance. So I think we...
They're
sure.
They really
yep. Like a wood carver with his wood. Yeah, I get that. I think you're hitting on one of the key aspects that struck me going over this was just the need to describe the benefits of these lists. You know, once we describe what is the benefit of being a historic property, then I can feel pretty comfortable about setting what are the restrictions of being a historic property. And I think there's like this landmark and proposed landmark. I think until we kind of settle on what is our, you know, if it's a loan grant program, if it's some other sort of offset we can do with other developments around the city, I don't know quite all the tooling that's available, but I keep kind of coming back to, I think the ordinance really does need to do a bit more in that realm, that until we get, and frankly, we can probably set a little bit of a line in the sand about how much we're willing to invest into those mechanisms without necessarily calling them out ahead of time and maybe direct staff to find what the best use of that sort of kitty of money, if that's how we were to put it, would be. But.
I think some of the ideas that you mentioned in your report, is it North Carolina, where
yep.
they abate taxes, but if you choose to get out of the program or demolish it or whatever, then you have to pay back 3 years' worth of those incentives or something like that. So there are ways to create
and
ways
some
to
of these
money.
Things can pay as you go. If you were to say, for example, on the average, new developments get 7%. Of the TIF funds applied to the project, and historic historic projects get 20%. I made that up. I'm not making a proposal. That would be a self-sustaining way to do that.
Mr. Hickey.
So I'm not sure what order we're taking these, but ones we're kind of...
Sorry, I had to break in.
So just at kind of a high level, so we look at the process to designate a property, and it's what the HPC, the homeowner, or the business owner, property owner, or the city council can nominate, and then there's a set of criteria, kind of a process to get on the list, and then a fairly rigorous process to get off the list, kind of the same players. But then jumping to the other category of potential landmark or designation, it seems like to get removed from the list, it's just a simple application by the property owner and staff review and you're off. It just seemed like between the two, it seemed like a very a big divide of process. And just maybe some of the background and philosophy on that, I guess.
I think, and I can try to tackle some from the conversations that we had, both with the smaller task force and the HPC, is that you probably will have a much larger number of these potential ones than your designated ones. And right now we're proposing 121. It could be anywhere plus or minus from that, depending on what we decide. But out of those, what percentage would truly qualify as a landmark property? Probably a fairly small percent. We don't know for sure because we can't. We could, but you'd have to pay for reviews of every one of these properties then. So what we try to do with that is that if we're trying to respect both sides of the issue by saying if it's important enough, we know we're going to designate it. It's a really hard process, but it's a more of a process to on and off and those sort of things. Whereas a potential, it almost goes back to the benefit side, where if you're a potential, you still qualify for some of the benefits. So we want to make sure those are enticing for you to stay on that list, potential list, or move to a landmark list to get the full benefits. But at the same time, if you're really opposed that my property should not be on this list, we felt that it should be that property owner's right then to remove himself. Now the council can always move any property onto that landmark list, which makes it a much more detailed process. But the feeling was is that if somebody looked and said, these benefits are worth it to be a potentially landmark property. I don't want to move up the landmark. I don't want to see its potential. I don't feel that property has any that value. And then they can apply to be removed from that. And that was a way to respect the property owner's rights on a property that's maybe a marginal, at best, to be on the list.
Go ahead. And then it sounds like there's going to be a pretty high bar to get on the list. So if we have to essentially make it all sound like we're going to hire a consultant every time to consider a property. I mean, that's a pretty rigorous process, as we call the 106 group who did the... I mean, it's not an insignificant amount of money to bring in a consultant to evaluate properties. So again, is that... we need a process, but is that almost going to be too high of a bar to get properties on in an orderly fashion?
Level of bar is the cost. I mean, and that could be depending on what consultant we eventually choose to, from who to talk to. It could be $3,000 to $5,000 per property for that review. But we are also then designating this property to have to follow a fairly strict set of operational rules for it and what they can use it for, how they can alter it, all those sort of things. So it's fairly standard in these sort of ordinances that it's there is a fairly detailed review and process needed to designate on a list. Because once property is designated, like I said, you can see in here what the requirements are for that property. So, it is difficult. Yeah, I don't know why.
Maybe I can help you with that. To get on the National Register, you first have to get past the state keeper of the register. It's a historic librarian, and they're pretty particular. They're very proud that they've never had one turned down. The next test after that is the state. Has to vote, so a committee of volunteers and a board approves it, and then the National Park Service approves it. And the reason you go through that process is you get 20% of the cost of the remodeling in a tax credit, a dollar-for-dollar reduction of taxes. But like federal programs, it's an inch-and-a-half thick book. It's complicated. It's backwards and forwards and 18 years to use it. Alternative minimum tax, it's a problem. Now, Senator Sinjum came up with sponsored a bill that gave also a state tax. 40% of the cost of the construction rebated in tax credits if you could find somebody with the tax liability to apply it to. On the federal program, if you unremodel the building over 5 years, there's a 5-year prorated 80-60-40-20 the give back that you have to refund the credit if you tore it down on the year two. On the state program, you can sell it back to the state for 90 cents on the dollar. So they give you 20 cents and then you give it back 8. The rigorousness of this is messy. But that's why people do it. To get a 40% reduction in your construction cost is a big deal.
Okay. I have Ms. Means, then Mr. Bildeback.
Hi. Thank you. You guys have done a great job. And just want to let you know that I, and I'm sure we all appreciate the work that you've done. You know, you mentioned you had a low percentage of businesses that were interested in this historic preservation process. Did I hear that correctly?
I don't know that that's true. What we said was we did a survey and we had 250 or so responses to Survey Monkey, and I think generally the public likes historic preservation, would be supportive of spending some tax dollars somehow. But they were not as extreme as the half dozen activists who thought that their opinion of public rights trumped the private owner's rights. And I don't know the answer to that. And I'm not politicking here. I'm just and even if we even if you pass an ordinance, the only applicable law that I know of at the state for stopping a demolition of a historic building is the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, and it doesn't fit very well. Our city staff are expert at it, but it's hard to protect something that they want to go down. Either they neglect it, or they burn it, or they ignore it, but it'd be hard to have an ordinance to force somebody to do something that they don't want to do.
Mr. Bildeback, then Ms. Wood.
I just had a couple other comments about this disruptive discourse. I don't know if an agenda would help or how you can include those public comments that are very important to all of us, that we have a mixed opinions and have that respectful conversations. And you also mentioned about handicap access. And that if you did the internal, that would be a retrofit then to many of, probably all of our historic buildings. Is that a correct statement?
It gets complicated. On the old city hall, that building is a two-story building with a basement by less than 1 inch. So it sticks out of the ground by an inch different than a story. It's a basement. We got all lost in the weeds as because there was an elevator in the building, did every building apartment have to be handicap accessible if we wanted to retrofit? And we spent weeks agonizing over that. If we have a kitchen with a loft above it, is that a mezzanine or a room? And we debated that at great length, and any one of these could have killed the project. It was really hard.
Well, of course, my concern about the handicap accessibility is that that would eliminate some people that need those accommodations for having the opportunity to live in that space.
Well, my proposal is not to waive anything. My proposal is just to be creative about it. My church got forced to fire sprinkle the sanctuary 20 years after the addition went on. Trap somebody in a fire in a one-story building with 5 exits.
Mr. Bildeback and Mr. Logan.
First of all,
thank you for your work. I watched a lot of these meetings and witnessed what was going on. And you're right, people are very passionate about this subject. I think Mr. Camping is correct that people may be more interested in participating if they saw what kind of funding sources the city would be willing to do besides what's out there state and nationally. My question is, we never got into the regional versus national. Do you want to comment on those types of issues? I know they were brought up to your group. I know you've had some discussion about them, but I'm curious what your regional versus national, because there are things that are people talk about historic based on what happened in this area by people who grew up in this area. So do you want to comment on regional versus national?
I don't know that we found good examples. The concept is something important to Rochester that's not important to the state of the nation. And so, for example, the Owatonna Orphanage had 100 years of orphans there. It was a great one. The city chose to embrace it. They actually took over the whole compound, put their city hall in the middle of a 100-year-old building, and really embraced it. Good for them. I happen to like it, but they worked really hard to find ways to use that campus. We didn't find an example of a corn tower or a Will and Charlie statue or a house that met one test and not the other, but I don't know that there aren't some. We just haven't found one yet. Fifth on Fifth was, I'll make another comment. So many of these seem to have the research all come out after somebody else's action takes place, and it's really hard to do that after the developer put his money down, so to speak. Fifth on Fifth was ugly. The Chardonnay was messy. The Kutsky House and the one next to it, I forgot the name.
Adamson.
Adamson House. Bitter, angry neighbor against neighbor who promised who what and didn't get it in writing. It's not the best government we could have. It needs to happen better than that somehow.
But I can comment that the ordinance does, you know, everything specifies the city's cultural, social, economic, political, architectural history. So the corn tower may have no historical impact on the state or the nation, but as a city, you may feel that that is a property worth designating as a landmark property. So when we do these reviews, the consultant used that would be taking a look at it would be looking at it through the context and lens strictly of the city of Rochester. They can take into account the broader state and national impact as well, but you know, ultimately that's what the focus is. It's our property. So you may have a number of properties that are determined to be landmark properties that would not be eligible for national designation, that would not make it through the state process for any of their funding, but are significant to the city of Rochester and thus would be designated as a landmark property for us and then be eligible for our incentives.
So you could help one that didn't meet the federal test.
Mr. Wojcik.
A few miscellaneous things. One thing I'm very positive about this, my understanding is that as this is written, it would be accepted, we'd be a certified local government, which that was important to me, and I think that's important to maintain going forward. I really think the citizen should at least have the ability to nominate, even if there's some restrictions on when that can be done, because ultimately the citizens can always come and, you know, file a letter, go to letters and petitions at the city council and ask us to initiate it. And I think this just kind of cuts out the middle step, because I don't know, you know, unless there was something immediately pending, I don't know why the council would not take a look if we received that request. And, you know, the Supreme Court's affirmed the rights of preservation, so it would be my preference to let citizens directly nominate. But I do think that we have to take a look at what happens when, you know, these nominations come at a time where, you know, a project is proposed, and I certainly understand the complexity there. I do have a lot of concerns about, you know, the potential landmark properties and how they're handled and how they're protected. In particular, we have a little bit of a stopgap measure in there right now that, you know, a building that I think, you know, locally everyone would see as being historic, a lot of those on 3rd Street, Broadway, 1st Avenue. There's a little bit of a stopgap that they can't at least get a demolition permit right now.
And if I understand the proposed ordinance correctly, I think that stopgap goes away, and there could be some staff-level opt-outs, and these buildings just get torn down in the dead of the night, and I'm not willing to give up the interim protections. I am very willing. I said from the start, and it certainly hasn't shown itself to be this way, that 95% of preservation in the community is not going to be particularly controversial, because it's largely going to be residential structures, which the owners are probably going to want them to be deemed historic, things like the Pill Hill Historic District. But we have this cluster of high economic activity, high land value around, you know, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Streets South, and Broadway and 1st Avenue. And, you know, a few months ago I suggested, why don't we just hire somebody and go through these buildings one by one and deem whether or not they're, you know, structurally sufficient and, you know, historically worthy of preservation, and, you know, foot the bill for what is truly going to be the really controversial area, and at least get to the point where we make some decisions on that. And I don't think the indecision that's out there right now is particularly helpful to the preservation community or to the potential redevelopment of some of these sites. But, you know, if you ask people of Rochester whether historic 3rd Street is historic, I think you'll have pretty good consensus that in fact it is. And I don't know if any of those buildings are necessarily protected by this ordinance right now, so that would be something that we'd have to consider. And, you know, I am a believer in both the stick and the carrot for the people. You know, the carrot is nice, but it doesn't always work. And I do think that if some of these potential buildings get torn down, I would like to see some steps where we prohibit incentive or restricted development capabilities, or cap the floor area ratios where they are pre-demolition. Some things to, you know, allow developers to maintain development rights, but not necessarily benefit from an expedited decision to tear down a property before it's properly evaluated. So those are a few of my concerns, but I think this ordinance is so much better than when we started out the process, and I really appreciate Jeff for taking a few body blows over the course of this to you know, hang in there and everything. Aaron too, yes. I know this is probably aging you folks a little bit too. I would really though, I'll put that plug in there again. I think we need to pony up, get the reviews done by an independent third party on these key historical, potentially historic downtown buildings that a lot of people care about. Make some decisions on these and move on with them. I don't think that this sitting out there one way or just abandoning them is going to get us anywhere.
Aaron, so just one second, just for fun. So if a property is a potential landmark within the ordinance,
okay,
and they're still on that potential landmark list and they apply for any sort of land use permit, which would include a demolition permit, there's a 60-day negotiation period, it's called, where nothing will be approved for 60 days to allow for the city time to deal with that issue. Whether it's to work through incentives that possibly could be available to, in your case, in a demolition conversation, to save a property, or realistically, within that 60-day period, the city council does have the authority to designate a property as a landmark property. And within that 60-day period, they could make that designation of a potential property, which would then initiate a new set of requirements for a demolition permit. But we did try to factor that in there. That, you know, but at the same time, if somebody removes their property as a potential, then no, there would not be really any protections under this ordinance if it's not on the list.
And that is that potentially a staff-level decision, too?
The way we have it set up in here right now, yes. It is, okay. It's basically a staff-level decision that we can move forward. But again, everything's up for discussion. This is what was kind of determined with that. And then also just a comment on 3rd Street. On our potential list, they are all on there.
They're on the potential list.
I think it's identified as a potential district for sure. So, as of right now, as in the draft.
You know, I guess, you know, a little bit of a, you know, plug to, you know, I don't want to beat up the activists. I read a great quote the other day that said the only thing that I'm hearing from the activists, the only thing worse than hearing from the activists in your community is when they go silent. And so, you know, I encourage them to keep being active.
Okay, Mr. Vogelback. So just to follow up with you, Aaron, who are the negotiating with? You said that the developer would negotiate with on site. Who is that?
City staff, basically. So it would be a sit down and be saying, okay, so you want to demolish this potential property. what can we work through here to see that not happen?
I just want to make sure.
What are our incentives? Do we have our land grant loan program available? Are you aware of the zoning incentives to be determined that you could use in a redevelopment process? All those sort of things. So yeah.
I just wanted to make sure we identified who's negotiating with them, because
we don't have a detail necessarily. Although we do have a comment in here for a assigned staff person, which is, as Terry comments, is unique. But it would be a point person at least, and okay. People would work through and help coordinate it.
Mr. Ruska?
That's what I was going to ask about the comments. I think Terry does a nice job of showing some things here. Assigned staff, is that a assigned like position? So let's say it's a city clerk, for example, and you move into a different position. Is the next, you know, does that assignment go with you, or does it stay with that designated position, or is that determined and approved by the council, or how is that done?
I think the intent was, and giving it wrong, is it's determined by the council. So you would say that, you know, this person, or, you know, you allow planning to present someone, or myself, or whoever it is, this is that person. If that person would leave or move on, the council would determine how to change that.
It might be a city administrator kind of role. I've done, I think, 7 TIF projects and had great success with but not Terry's faith. And as long as they're in the city, they might, you know, it might be one of their hats.
Would it be up to the council to make that final decision?
Yeah, I think the intent was the council to make that decision, but it was also the conversation about the one point of contact. Mm-hmm. So you could work through all these, because there's a lot involved with these projects, not only locally with our departments within the city and with planning, but it's just on the state and national level for different programs that are available. So it can get confusing if you are trying to work with 6 different agencies.
And everybody thinks their rules are the rules. So the preservation office has a different set of rules than ADA or the fire department or the building department, and it's really hard to marry them together.
I just see the staff person, whoever it may be, as being a key player in this process. So, you know, I mean, it's important on what kind of, who picks them and what kind
it's
of...
It's a senior role. It's not a junior role.
Yeah, exactly.
The intent was the city council.
All right. I have Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Campion.
Just to pick up again on Michael's point, if we were going to do some kind of further review of the proposed list, if you could refresh my memory, how much analysis did the 106 group do? What would it take to flesh that out, or how much work has been done already?
They've done most, I mean, all these properties that are on the potential list have had the initial analysis done. So it would basically just be like a final sort of review thing. And like I said, the quotes we were getting were maybe $3,000 to $5,000 per property to do that final thing. But it could be different, because my recommendation would be that we do some sort of RFP to pick a consultant to work with so we have consistency. I don't think it would help us to use a different consultant for each project or, you know, things like that. I think we should have one that we feel comfortable with that we can consistently work with. And I would assume part of that process is that we'd set a fee that they would, you know, provide us. Because, like I said, we have all the initial work. I mean, I think it's still out on our large document server. It's a very massive document of all the property information for the ones that are on the potential list. So they can take that as their basis, do the final work to answer the questions that are detailed in the ordinance, and then provide that back.
I believe there's 5 criteria that qualify for National Register. Something important happened, it's a good example. They're almost always over 50 years old, except for a 40-year-old one I know about. But, you know, they always meet generally certain criteria. So when I've had them written, there's a consultant that has to generate. The actual form is, I think, 2 pages, but you have a 5-page narrative behind it and usually some photographs. So it's a week or 2 weeks' work, but the ones that have succeeded have been a PhD level. It kind of ripped what was happening in the world at that time, pre-Civil War, pre-World War I. I mean, it's a story. That layman, I've tried to write them and been rejected and had to hire somebody and they do it over and I say, oh, God, wish I'd thought of that. You know, and you move on.
All right. Yeah, Mr. Campion, then Ms. Means.
So one of the, we kind of touched on it, proposed landmark, I as an owner can basically come to staff and it says, it looks like the ordinance basically says, if I say I'm not interested in the tax incentives, the staff shall remove. So it's not a discussion. I'm not interested. You take me off. I then pull out from my other pocket. So in one pocket I have the removal, and the other pocket I have the demo permit. we basically, there's no protection for somebody that's on that list, correct? Because it's...
Once they remove themselves from the list, there's no protection.
And there's no thought into this. This is a, as long as I say I'm not interested, I am removed.
What, and I can give you the general background on that, was the weighing of both sides of the property owner who owns the property versus the wanting for preservation.
Yeah.
And that's where that has come from. So again, the HPC knows that this is a very touchy topic. The HPC and everybody involved recognize that that's going to be a big issue that the council's going to discuss, is how do you get yourself off these lists.
Right.
The landmark one is very detailed. We get that. But the potential one, we left it basically, if you want off, you're off. But that's something the council's going to need to make a decision on if they want to leave it that way or if they want to make it a more difficult process.
I'll offer my personal opinion. It got so much heat. I'm not, personally, by one vote, I'm not satisfied we made a great decision there. It was so extreme. When I think back, like at the Kutsky House, when I think we had 70 items of provenance, and the owner said, wow, if there was never a mortgage recorded, it never happened. And that was persuasive, you know. HPC got overruled. So, you know, these are going to be worked out in court, I bet.
So, and just to make sure, there's at least three designations here. There's proposed, potential, and landmark.
It's a potential landmark. Basically, it's just
either you're a landmark,
yep,
or you're potentially a landmark.
Yep, that's it.
Or a district.
Okay.
Or
the
district.
Document
so
I had, I think, said
district. Right.
Okay, all right.
And that provision about the owner being able to remove him, his or her property, only deals with potential landmark.
Okay, that's here's
correct.
What I missed.
Yeah.
The document that literally is titled proposed, well, it's proposed potential landmark. So there you go. Mm-hmm. I get it now.
Okay. I wanted to follow up quickly on something Mr. Campion touched on. The rationale for the two-year wait. So, you know, a scenario might be I get off the list and I think it says can't get back on for 2 years. What if I sell the property and the next owner wants to get back on? What was the rationale for this?
It was heavily debated, but really the rationale was is that we are presenting you, this is, you know, a program, we have a lot of stuff out there. You say, nope, I want to be off it. Then you're off. You make some changes, do some things to your property that probably, possibly wouldn't have been approved by the HPC or the council. And then all of a sudden you're saying, oh, I'm going to go back on now because I want some money to do something else that I think you guys would approve. And we wanted to avoid that bounce back. We recognize it could be fine-tuned, where if an ownership changes or things, but we also had a conversation of, well, if it goes from one LLC to the next, do we dig deep enough to see that it's still the same owner, really? They just changed, you know, names or whatever. But there is that risk that somebody says, nope, I want off the potential list. They do some changes, but then they come back and say, you know what, I think I want back on that list now. Can I get back on? Can I do whatever? And, you know, so that was basically the rationale.
And I agree.
Right or wrong,
we might want to fine tune that. I was just looking for the initial rationale.
The state preservation. No. I'm sorry. Do you want me
go
to
ahead.
Come?
Yeah, go ahead.
State Preservation Office declined to put Old City Hall on the National Register if I remodeled the City Council chamber. They said that's the historic big button thing. And as a developer, I didn't think I could rent the basement without having the cool lofts. So I said, I'll do without the tax credit. So now here I am 20 years later. Do I want to get on the list? And it depends on the incentives.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Ms. Meadles.
I just wanted to get back to the survey that was sent out. I wonder, since there are such, you know, this 40% remain on construction, which you talked about earlier, as well as the process and how perhaps there would be some money through those other resources like the state and the park, perhaps 20% tax credit. If you put that in a fact sheet or something to the public or to the builders to describe those benefits.
We did start a list. We kind of wanted to get a sense of your appetite. We have a list of, I think, 14 kinds of grant and subsidy funds. If you wanted the whole big extreme, for example, I bought an old boarding house in Spring Valley and got $900,000 on a $1.2 million project of subsidy, and it's still an economically bad project. But I did get a National Register building saved. I mean, you know, I mean, some of these subsidies are going to be monstrous if you really mean to do it. And I'm not pitching that today, but, you know, revolving loans in my, you know, in Faribault, which is a good historic town, they do revolving loans. They don't do grants, and they don't get their what they want done. Hmm. So you got to have to, if you give us some guidance, we're happy to carry out the mission. And I'll make one more comment. Thanks, yeah, it's been a hard job. I promised the mayor I'd step up and take some hits. This is not my terminal job with the city, and I do not intend to be chair forever.
So,
may I ask one other question, and that is about the demolition of property, and it goes through the process and through Mr. Johnson's organization that before it's done. Is there a problem with having those demolitions come to the council and have some public comment on it or some dialogue at all, or you think that's too burdensome?
No, if it's a landmark property, it is detailed in here. It does ultimately have to be approved by the council if it's a demolition.
What if it's potential?
Potential is not, that's not.
If you ask me, I think the Preservation Commission, as it finds its legs, should act as good and as bad as the Planning and Zoning Commission does. You know, I mean, pluses and minuses to it, but it would be my hope that the Preservation Commission can save you from some of this. We would do some of the debates just once instead of twice or three times.
Okay, question for you. The ordinance as it's currently crafted, is it your opinion that it couldn't stand on its own? In other words, if we don't marry this up with some sort of incentive package, the ordinance in and of itself would most likely not work?
My opinion? I don't think without a subsidy you can get it. There's a building in town that's a National Register property, and the RDA offered 50-50 matching funds for $20,000 to tuck point it, and the owner passed because he couldn't come up with the $20,000. Every old building I know is more tired than every new building I know, even the ones that have been helped, and I just don't think you'll get what you want without a check in hand of some kind.
And I make that point because I think the council will have to seriously consider that as we go forward, and if we consider enacting this revised ordinance, we're going to have to talk seriously about, you know, the hard part, about the funding part, or if they don't go together, the package, I think it'll be difficult. Mr. Wojcik.
I make one more comment. One of the things that happens nationally is the land grows much more valuable than the land plus building. When I bought the old city hall from the city, it was $450,000 for the land minus $250 to scrape off the building, and I bought it as a raw piece of land and just kept it. I believe the land is worth three times more than the capital value of the building today. And at a certain point, if somebody offered you the check, when would you take it? Boy, they're big numbers. I mean, that's what happened to the Chardonnay. It was much too expensive to recover, and the land was much more valuable as a new building. So if somehow your subsidy program, if you really mean to keep these artifacts, has to acknowledge the value of the raw land.
Okay, Mr. Wojcik.
I think that you know, one of the opportunities that we have in Rochester, and I think the Conley Mass Building shows us that, you know, that's purely a two-story building that, and the incentives that we put into that one essentially were the 40% from the federal and state tax credits, which doesn't cost us anything, and then we put some TIF into that, but it does, because we're Rochester and not necessarily one of the smaller surrounding towns, the rents and the ability to earn income off these existing buildings is a little bit more substantial here than it is in some of those other places. And I think that looking at that Conley Mass, I think that's a very good model to look at in terms of what we can offer potentially to developers, and perhaps marrying that with some of the existing grant funds. I really do wish there was something like the Mills Act in Minnesota. I discussed this before. I believe this was out of California, where they you could actually on historic properties, you could do a write down of the taxable value of the particular property, because ultimately it's preserved and the opportunity for redevelopment is lessened by that. And
is it facade easement that does some of that?
I think that would be helpful. It's something that we could do fairly easily as well. And I do think too that when we're looking at these buildings, I think we'll find, particularly on Broadway, one that I'm thinking of is there are some buildings that are, very historic in nature, but we need to, certify, and probably using a preservation architect is the way to do this, that it needs to have the whatever character criteria makes it historic, but it also has to be structurally sound. And I think that's where, we really benefit by, ponying up and getting that review done, because I suspect that we have a number of buildings that may have some structural deficiencies and others, that are outstanding on Broadway in terms of their structural strength still. So I don't know how we get past some of these obstacles without actually, going in and evaluating some of these properties that are potentially controversial, and, I'm happy to do that whenever. But I'm optimistic. Conley Mass shows that it works in downtown Rochester. And that's, merely a two-story building.
So. I think another part of the reason for my question, too, about the ordinance is, hypothetically, one of the next steps could be that we take this forward for formal public hearing and, move forward towards adoption. But I think we're going to have to, in parallel, talk about some of those financial incentives or that program. Otherwise, enacting the ordinance just in and of itself would be... it'd be only halfway there. And at one point, Mr. Bildebeck's next, and then Mr. Mayor, I'd like to get your opinion too. Mr. Bildebeck?
Just go back to the potential buildings. If they request to get off, there is no waiting period, there is no discussion about any potential assistance out there, they just are immediately dropped.
If they request it, they're off that list.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. And then I want to go back to something Jeff talked about earlier when he talked about nonprofits or private versus public. Or can you expound a little more on that? Where do you see the big hang-up, the difficulty, if there's incentives offered?
Well, I mean, some of these get complicated with in particular state statutes. You can't do a TIF for a church. So if Calvary Episcopal was going to get remodeled, he couldn't help it. I was at the Rochester Fest Parade and saw a Harold Crawford house that was a three-bedroom, one-bath house turned into a five-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath house, and they didn't... It looks great. It looks like a Harold Crawford house still, but it didn't meet any of the Secretary of the Interior standards because you can't tell the old from the new, and they didn't keep the character-defining elements the same. So it wouldn't have qualified for any of the tax credits. So it's in the details. I don't know if you could funnel money to the Mitchell Student Center through the Mayo ownership entity. I don't know that you could or couldn't. It'd be one of these complicated syndications. If you wanted to keep the Salvation Army existing soup kitchen, it's an Allerby building, it's old enough, it's got some history. I don't know if it's valuable or not, but you'd get lost in these details of trying to preserve the character-defining elements and make a building that's not usable.
So you just stayed really away from it because of that?
You might. I mean, you got to have some kind of creative insight. A lot of banks thought I was a dummy for putting apartments in City Hall. We live downtown and there's no yard. It's turned out okay for 20 years. But
with the ordinance right now, I mean, anyone is eligible. We don't. That was part of the conversation, but it didn't get put in, is that we didn't say that if you're not a tax-paying property, you're not eligible. But as Jeff said, it would depend on what you're eligible for. Obviously,
some of the funding stuff, so you wouldn't qualify for community right. development block grants.
TIF,
you wouldn't qualify for TIF. You may not get a RPU rebate. You know.
But if we have a loan grant program, they could get that.
No, Michael mentioned TIF works. TIF worked in the Conley Moss case. It's a good project. Our office did a lot of work on it. And you're proud to be part of that, Terry and Brent. But you have to have enough increment to make those work. And a lot of historic properties probably won't have that. The only other kind of tax avoidance thing that would work is tax abatement. The issue with tax abatement is it shows up then as a levy increase on your next year's city tax levy. Of course, with a small amount, it's not a huge deal. But, you know, there have been other projects that have come in that were potentially historic where TIF wouldn't work because it just is not, there's not enough bump there to between the current taxes and the improved taxes. In the Conley Moss case, they put enough in improvements that it made that work.
Well, you got to meet the but-for test. Usually everybody wants their dollar to be the last dollar that tips the project into going ahead. And so you have third parties trying to determine if you have a viable project and give you the very least amount of money to help you do it. It's counterintuitive, at least.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Mayor.
Sorry, one more thought. But if you really wanted to go a whole hog, conduit, municipal bonds, bond funds, cheap interest mortgages, I mean, you could really have a big impact on some of those without putting the city at risk.
Okay. Mr. Mayor.
Well, I first naively just thought, why can't we just try this and see if it works? And then, but the discussion that's been going on, it's obvious that one of the things that will have to happen is, whether it's TIF, whatever kind of subsidy or whatever we might be able to do. But I appreciate the amount of work that's been done already. And there's been some good comments that I don't think you're ready to sign off on it today, but and the idea of maybe having some kind of a public hearing for more input, but I'm optimistic that we can get something going and get something done.
Mr. Woodyard?
Well, I was just curious because I've done some work with the syndicating credits in the affordable housing arena. And it does look like the IRS ruled that you can actually syndicate and transfer historic tax credits to other groups if you're a nonprofit investor. So I think there's still those opportunities out there.
The way you do that is you have to be at risk. So I sold $800,000 of credits to an oil company in Red Wing. But you got buy-sell agreements and put agreements, and it's messy. And the Preservation Alliance is expert at this.
Okay.
And they're doing the ones with a bunch of George Sherman projects in Minneapolis, and he's going to be recognized. He's done a bunch of them. It can be done.
Anyone else? And again, Mr. Campion.
I guess I would say, and maybe in the nature of government, somebody has to kind of take a leap. I would be, the idea of taking a delisting a potential property, I think, has to come back to the council probably. I'd be interested in seeing that as a process. I think part of it is to, as much as staff works to probably protect us from decisions that can have some flack, I also think at the same time that the council needs to step up when things like this are going on and potentially a hot button issue and probably take a leadership role there to make sure it doesn't look like things are happening underneath the covers. I think that probably increases the transparency a little bit of the entire process if we can bring it back to a public setting to have that discussion about, you know, this homework. Maybe it doesn't become a public hearing. Maybe we put it on the consent agenda. We can figure out how to then pull it and discuss it if it has to be discussed that way. I think item two I had was, does this seem like I can't tell if this is like a CIP capital sort of planning we should be doing for funding some of these mechanisms that would come out of here. I guess I would kind of look for some advisement of...
Depends upon the amount.
Yeah.
How much you use every year.
I mean, I would think we're talking in the probably hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah, I know what I know your thumb up. I knew where your thumb was going to go, but...
If you have a continuing program, you're going to have to levy for it.
Right, for long term. But if we wanted to bootstrap something to get off the ground...
Hopefully we could find something.
And potentially, if the properties are located downtown, we could use some sales tax money for the downtown.
Possibly. And I'm not necessarily
opposed to... Well, the rub with preservation is you have to unbuild something and then rebuild it and work around all kind of constraints. So it's that's where it's hard.
I was saying that I'm not necessarily opposed to what Mr. Campion is saying, that, you know, there maybe should be more scrutiny to get off the list. But I'm also looking at some balance. In other words, it takes a fair amount of rigor to get on the landmark list and rigor to get off. Mm-hmm. I mean, council approve it either way. But on the potential side, if it's pretty easy to get on the list, it could be a citizen letter, for example, then I wonder if it shouldn't be somewhat easy to get off the list.
I totally agree. So I guess what we do with other maps, right, with eminent domain claims is basically they can start a timer. And we could set it up such that if someone's on the potential list and they want off, it starts a 90-day period in which we either, as a council, would act to fund the review process in that time and get it reviewed, or they would go off. Is that a model we could work out?
And so you would build in a timer mechanism within the ordinance?
So basically, once they gave staff notice that they wanted to be considered for removal, that would then bring it to the council, say, are we going to fund or not fund the review process for this property?
That could be built in, yes.
Okay.
That's how the demolition was. I mean, you apply it, and after the aging period, we...
I don't know. I think that there's room here.
All right, that's a good point. I like that. Mr. Hickey?
And if you could clarify for me, I guess, to get on the potential list, isn't it still nomination by HPC, City Council, or business owner?
Yes.
So it wouldn't be as something as simple as a citizen.
So unless they went to the council member and asked
sure.
the council member to do it, and the whole council would do it. Yes.
Sure.
That would be, that's right. How it, it's the same for both.
That's
I'd like to think the HPC could do it. In my opinion, when we had the flap with the Kutsky House and the Adamson House, a whole lot of great facts emerged that the owners probably didn't know. You know, the Conley Mosque, I looked at it too. I didn't know all the rich provenance of it. Until late, much later in the process. So,
okay, Mr. Ruska.
So did that change how they felt about it then?
Yeah, actually.
Because I think I like, if we're going to have this in there, I'd like it to be the owner that's requesting to be on the list, not somebody that just thinks that's a cool building.
Well, it's way better if you have the owner because he's got the abstract, he's got access, he can come on the property.
I think
the way I liken it is if you inherited your grandmother's platinum wedding band, that's a huge monster family keepsake. But once it's at the pawn shop, it's just old platinum. And so how do you distinguish these closely held, intensely felt family heirlooms from just junk?
Well, and I think that might enter into the council decision and discussion. I mean, I like that idea of comes to the council, somebody wants off the list, do we feel it's worth funding to do the research to see if it truly belongs on the list or is it potential? And I think something that would factor into that discussion is, well, who brought the request forward to begin with? You know, the property owner or, you know, some other interested party?
See, the half barrel, the tap house, the grand rounds, I mean, none of those meet the Secretary of the Interior standards. And I think they're great examples of adaptive reuse of historic buildings, but they wouldn't meet the rigorous application of the criteria.
Okay.
I guess I don't know enough to know whether or not they would. I know there's a lot of people that feel that they would, but I'm not qualified to make that judgment. My only thing is, and I understand that we need to keep things moving, so I like your suggestion of the timer. The key thing is, you know, we just have to make sure we set it up so there's an adequate time for review because, you know, those places like whenever we make a decision on, you know, whether or not historic Third Street or is historic, we want to make sure that we have the analysis done correctly before we make that decision, which I imagine will be pretty final at that point, probably because there'll be pending demolitions.
So, you know, one of the things we'd like to do is reach some sense of closure today in terms of where would you like to go next. I mean, I think
the groups have done a great job putting together an ordinance for our consideration. And ideally, we'd like to come out of this today with what's the next step, Mr. Hickey?
Yes, I guess, you know, and I think this is a productive way to go about it, kind of talk about the big issues that we did today. But as we look at all the footnotes the city attorney put in, and there's obviously a lot of technical issues, just to, you know, punch this ordinance, punch it up a little bit. And what would be the process for that? I mean,
Well, good question, and I'm open to ideas. Many of the comments were just that, comments. Here's the reason that it's here or not here, and or that this is significant. All right, you know, there were commentary. I wasn't seeing a lot of suggested changes to the draft ordinance, unless you...
I did hold back on some of the, like, so I knew, maybe is the best way to forward them to the city attorney for a review, or there's a whole bunch of little, like, nits I just wanted to get, make sure I understood.
I guess I'm thinking, I think if we have some suggestions or whatever, I think we got to, you know, the devil's in the details, and what we're doing today is we're not looking at the details. And so, you know, we're just kind of looking at the, you know, upper level view at it. And I think some of these things may be sent to the city attorney for incorporation, and then a draft sent out to us is, you know, gives us a chance to say, are we ready to move forward yet? Or, I'm just trying to figure out how to get moving forward, because I think we all have a few little things that we'd like to ask about or throw in there that if we all did it, we'd be here till 7 o'clock, you know, so.
But I'm a little bit uncomfortable with going any further without knowing that I've got your blessing. For example, the site alteration permit. The first time I saw that, I assumed there was something called a site alteration permit. There is no such thing. Aaron told me that it's just a catch-all referral phrase. Well, why would you put it in there if there's no such thing as a site alteration permit? So I'm not very comfortable trying to go forward now and substituting what I think it should read or whether something should be in there or not, unless somebody on this council tells me, if the group that tells me, this is what we want to see.
Mr. Wojcik?
I think that you get into the, you know, I have a few proposed changes that I would make, and I think maybe the best way to do it is set a date, whether it be next Monday or the following Monday, to introduce proposed changes, and then we'll see which ones we count four on and which ones we don't.
And I kind of agree with Michael on this one. I think if we would send them to one place and get them all put together so we can all look at them, I think that would be a better way to do it. But then I also agree with Michael that down the road we need to set a date so we can take a look at these and then kind of hash them out and then let Terry know which ones we want to have put into the ordinance and which ones not. And that way he doesn't have to play the guessing game. Mm-hmm. That way he gets the instructions that he's looking for.
Yeah.
And we can hash it all out, because I agree, everybody's got a couple little ones that they'd like to see more detail on or hear more out. So that would be my suggestion, so we decide who they go to, whether we send them all to Aaron or we send them to Steve or whoever to gather them, and send them back out to the council and give us a week or so to take a look at them so we can hash what each council member has said, and then come back here and have a discussion and figure out what we want Terry to do with them.
That's exactly the process the HPC used to get to, basically to get to this. Once they got a draft ordinance, they all provided me the comments.
Thanks for offering.
I tried
what a generous offer. Exact as the.
And then we sat down with the HPC as a whole and went through basically everyone, checked off, whatever, until we got to a final.
So we'll send them all to you.
I'm glad you offered. Thank you.
Well, I just had
a comment. We'd like the task force and HPC to be involved at some point, because we have a lot of, we've got 3 years of hard work for this, and so you don't want to disenfranchise those groups. They got a lot of effort into it.
Mm-hmm. We'll have a public hearing at some point.
Well, yeah. To a point.
That disfranchising language bothers me a little bit. I think at this point, the elected officials need to give some direction.
Right.
There'll be plenty of opportunity for others to respond and provide input. I don't see that as disenfranchising.
I agree with that.
I see this as you performing your role.
Okay.
Yep. Mr. Campion?
So I realize that we're working against a deadline here. The only other broader topic that wasn't just a nitpick was the certificate of economic hardship. I kind of wrote down that I felt like the tests around that were pretty there was a list of items that could be involved, but the test wasn't very clear. So, like, what exactly qualified you? There's a whole bunch of, like, you can bring all this supporting evidence, but not really how is the council, how would we agree to reach a decision? So that was another spot that I hit on that.
There is no good answer to that. It's one that will, I think, get, when you look at it, gets challenged the most legally. And we basically, I believe, for this one, used the national standard sort of wording for it, which tends to be
so it's less likely to get challenged with no test than with a test.
It leaves it up to council discretion. There's room for council discretion, or ultimate decision board making discretion. And then at that point, if it's challenged, it's, you know, did the, you know, it looked at as did the council board, whoever it was, take in the information needed and make a reasonable decision, you know, their authorities, okay, that sort of thing.
So could we set a date that people would submit any comments they have to Aaron so that he can collect them together, and then he would give them back out to the council so we'd see the collective wisdom, and then we can schedule a date, another COW meeting date, to decide and determine which of those might actually be included or edited.
Friday? Is Friday this week, or people going to be writing a lot? I just have the ones I've already written. I don't plan on generating more.
I don't know that we need a lot of time, because we've all given this a lot of thought.
Next Friday.
That's 2 days.
It's short for me. I'm extremely busy the next couple of days. But
after the 12th.
After the 12th, I'm feeling better. Until then, it's
all right, so how about the 15th for, we'd have,
a week from Friday?
Yeah, let's do that.
So I'm fine with that.
A week from Friday to get any comments into Aaron. Can turn those back around to us.
Okay. Would you like me to send out the draft funding policy?
Yes.
HPC's done it. We've just been waiting to present it. We don't want to clutter the issue, but I know they're tied together.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, 14,
and then I think it'll depend on the volume and magnitude of the changes, how quickly we can bring that back and work through them. But and then eventually, I assume we'll have a public hearing. We have the final draft ready to go. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else then for this afternoon? We have a busy evening tonight. So. All right. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.
Good hard work.
Yeah.